Today's show is sponsored by Ting. Go to dancarlin.ting.com for a $25 service credit when you sign up with Ting.
Your canary in a coal mine since 1994. It's Common Sense with Dan Carlin.
Stay tuned to the end of this program today. I'm going to have a little update on how things are going with the Hardcore History Show and some other things, you know, sort of insider business things on what we do here on the podcast. If you care about that, we'll have a little bit of info on that at the end. If you don't, just tune out when you hear the boom at the end and you'll be good. I don't know when you're going to get this program, but last night was the first of the Republican primary debates. Fox News ran one and put 10 of the 17 declared GOP hopefuls up there to have a little discussion. And we were live tweeting, we, the royal we. I was live tweeting during the event. And, you know, we don't do a whole lot on our at DC Common Sense Twitter feed, but now and again we'll do something like that. And I was thinking about a few things today, and I thought, you know, this is worth discussing a little bit, especially for people outside the United States who may not understand exactly how the U.S. primary system works, and I don't blame them. The primaries are one of the really sort of, it's one of the places where, in my opinion, the American electorate kind of gets shafted, and they're controlled in a way by the two parties, the whole nomination process that always puts us in the position of saying, really, these two candidates are the best we have to choose from. And then you get into the famous lesser of two evils, voting pattern, and all of that stuff really begins in the primary part of the system here, right? This is where the choices that you're going to have, you know, come presidential election time are made. And there's a lot of stuff, lots of ins and outs and places in the whole process where there's just so much ability for the parties or whomever to kind of control who eventually gets the gig. And I think, by the way, you might be able to make a case, and I think some people have today, that you kind of saw a little bit of it on display last night at the debate. The debate featured Donald Trump, who's never served in political office at all, and a bunch of people up there besides him who have. He's a fascinating dynamic of these political times, and I want to get into that in a minute, but he's also extremely destabilizing and is like nuclear waste to the Republican Party. And I think you saw the way this debate was organized, only on Fox News, by the way, Fox News Channel. They were the, you know, I was surprised, by the way. I didn't even pay attention to that and turned on other news channels, and there was no debate. And it was, the debate was supposed to be starting, and I switched around. And once I landed on Fox, which was on the, you know, jump button anyway for this debate, but I looked and I thought, oh, yeah, that's right. This is sort of an exclusive debate. But it also allowed a network that has a particular, you know, slant, which, as a lot of people out there would probably say, which network doesn't. But in this case, it's a conservative slant, and I think they kind of went after Trump initially, because I don't think the power brokers in the Republican Party want to see Trump, and I can't blame them. Now, a little disclaimer here at the outset. I don't like the man. I've never liked the man. His rise to fame and prominence it corresponds to my own aware life. I mean, in the 70s, when we first started hearing about them, I was old enough to be paying attention, watched them all through the 80s, 90s. You know, I mean, if you wanted to put together a human being that combined a bunch of the elements of personal human qualities that are not my favorite, he incorporates a lot of them in one person. I don't think he'd be a good president. I don't think he'd be a good elected official at all. He's not my kind of guy. But I've often said to you that they don't have to be my kind of guys to have an impact on the system. And I like people who make the two parties and the status quo sweat. Now, sometimes they make them sweat because they say things that are really, you know, appeal to voters. I mean, things that are normally off the table. And sometimes they make the parties and the status quo sweat because, well, they're justifiably dangerous to them. The worst thing that might happen to the Republican Party is Donald Trump somehow winning the nomination, because you have to question whether or not he could win the general elections. This is a huge problem in the way the entire primary process works. It encourages a certain kind of candidate, and then that candidate gets in the general elections, and because that candidate was not picked by most Americans, is often poorly suited to the general electorate. And this describes you know, both parties, not just the Republican. The person who's able to say the right things and adopt the right approaches for, say, the people who have to vote in these early primaries, which are often key, those are very different points than you would use if you were voting elsewhere. Case in point, Richard Nixon's famous comments, which is widely understood. Nixon's the guy who gets quoted, but everybody understands this. Nixon, remember, is running as a Republican. If you are running as a Democrat, you kind of have the opposite advice. Nixon famously said that when you run in the primary elections as a Republican, you run to the right. And then once you win those, you move back toward the center and moderate your views for the general elections, right? Because you have to appeal to people now that are a much more liberal crowd than the people you had to appeal to get the nomination. This impacts everything those people at the debate last night were saying. They are weighing their positions and trying to look as authentic as possible, more authentically conservative than the other people up there, right? Everybody kind of wants to be, you know, first over the line by a little bit. No one wants to be so far off the radar that, you know, the general public out there, the Americans in the main election, will say, wow, this person's crazy. Did you hear what he said in the primary debates to get elected? You don't want to go over that line, but you need to be more authentically conservative than the other people you're running against. That's the way the game normally works. But you don't normally have a Donald Trump in the race. The reason they don't like third parties and independent candidates in this electoral system, the Democrats and Republicans, is because they don't play by the playbook. Now, they've done a pretty darn good job, Democrats and Republicans, of making it very difficult for those third party or independent people to be in any position to question the playbook, right? We talk all the time, don't we, about how there are barriers to third party candidates. There are debates that are controlled by the two parties. There's a lot of ways to lock out any voices that aren't part of the two main parties. The problem now for those two main parties comes when people who really are outsiders run under their banner. Bernie Sanders is doing this in the Democratic Party. And it's the same problem that they're having over there that the Republicans are having with Trump. And isn't that a weird thing to say? Because is there any other similarity between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump? But the idea is the same. Bernie Sanders makes the Democratic Party sweat, makes the status quo over there that's ready to, you know, give a coronation to Hillary, makes them sweat. And he's not a Democrat. In fact, he's the only non-Democrat and Republican in the Senate. He's officially an independent. You probably know he's a self-declared Democratic Socialist, which I think really hurts his chances once he comes to the general election. But he can play populist to the left of Hillary Clinton, and there's a lot of people in the Democratic Party who'd like to see someone other than Hillary Clinton, if for no other reason than there's almost this knee-jerk reaction to the sheer sense of inevitability, the very thing that the party leaders in the Democratic Party look at as a plus for her, the inevitable candidate, is something that a lot of Democrats, even though I think they'd love to see a woman candidate and a strong woman candidate, I think a lot of them don't like the inevitability question, right? They want people to be challenged, and they want choices, and who can blame them? And they want the candidate that eventually gets the job to be the one that's been able to prove themselves sort of in combat. The party doesn't want that, though, because it's, you know, the way we would describe it in news is you would call it a bruising primary battle. You don't want your candidate to get beat up by members of their own party before the general election happens and you open yourself up to being beaten by the other party, right? You want as best as possible a candidate to get to the general elections as tan, rested, and ready, as the old line about Nixon used to go, as tan, rested, and ready as they can to take on, you know, the opposing party's candidate. If Hillary Clinton goes limping into the general elections because Bernie Sanders got her to, you know, make all these statements that start dogging her in the media, the Democratic Party's not going to be happy with that situation, and they're certainly not going to be happy with Bernie Sanders or any of the Democrats that supported him. So they're sort of at cross purposes. They try to shut down independents and third-party candidates. It's a lot tougher, certainly when the entire country is watching, to shut down what are essentially third-party or outsider candidates within a party. Now, you saw this on display with Trump quite a bit last night, where a lot of the questioning had this sometimes subtle, sometimes pretty open undercurrent, where people were questioning whether Donald Trump was even a Republican at all. One of the very first things that was done was, and again, it seemed weird. The people at Fox got a lot of credit for doing the debate well by the other networks, or doing a good job at the debate might be a better way to say it. I didn't see that. I thought the whole thing looked awkward, and, you know, it was funny because it was scripted, but scripted to sound like it wasn't scripted, but you really have to pull that off well. And while I think all those people were professionals up there, they certainly were, I thought it sounded like scripted off-the-cuff banter, if that makes any sense. And by the way, most of the candidates sounded like that too. Nonetheless, the awkward thing that happened right at the beginning that seemed to show, in my opinion, you know, that Fox was kind of in league, if you will, with the GOP on this, was this pledge. They said to all the candidates, "Will you all pledge right now that if you don't get the nomination, you won't run as a third-party person?" And the first thing that happened was I thought, "What? I mean, what?" And then when Donald Trump raised his hand, the funny thing is again, this is why the two parties don't like outsiders, because they're totally unpredictable. When Trump raises his hand and says, "I won't make that pledge," the way the entire thing is set up, the way the Fox question is set up, the way the pressure that's then going to come from the other Republicans up there is set up, is to make Trump look bad in front of Republican voters. "Look at this son of a bitch. He only cares about himself. He doesn't care about Republicans. Are you even a Republican? Would you even support the nominee if it's not you?" And instead, he ended up looking like the one guy, you know, with the guts to say, "I'm not here to support a party. You know, I do what I think is right." And then Rand Paul started slamming him essentially for not being a good party man. You see, and I thought to myself, that's not a good position for Rand Paul to take. Because this is the funny thing. I'd be a pretty good consultant for an outsider independent candidate, because I think I really know what appeals to me. As I told you, Trump has all these personal qualities I can't stand. But he's going up against a bunch of people that are playing this game by a playbook. And I think you could see it if you were watching last night. They all sounded like robots, didn't they? Except for one guy, Trump. He didn't sound like a robot because he's not operating by that same playbook. Now, if he's operating against a bunch of other people that also aren't operating by a playbook, I think he gets his clock cleaned. I think he looks, I mean, I don't think it would have been tough at all. And I think in the junior league debate, where the seven people who didn't make it in the main debate debated, the one woman on the GOP slate, Carla Fiorina, she basically said that about Trump. She said he's tapping into something that Americans feel, but how would he govern? What are his political, you know, parameters, sort of? I forgot the word she used, but she was essentially saying is, you know, okay, so he's a bunch of statements, but how does the man govern? Those are great points. A lot easier to make if you're also an outsider who's not bound by the, you know, conventions. All these other people sounded like they'd spent way too long drinking coffee and preparing their responses to points with their consultants. They all sounded like robots, and they sounded like they were all, you know, if you watch a lot of debates, and if you've been in a few of them, the first thing you know if you've been in front of crowds like that, and I've been in front of the crowds, I haven't been in front of the millions of people, so imagine how much worse it must be in front of the millions of people, but you sit there, and you're trying to keep track of what you want to say. And I've gone up there and forgotten what I want to say sometimes, so let's point that out. So I had a lot of sympathy for, like, Ben Carson, who I thought looked like, okay, he's trying to, he knew what he wanted to say, but he wasn't sure about the order, and he had some things he wanted to slip in, but maybe he wasn't sure if it was the right time for that. And you saw that over and over with these candidates. Sometimes you'd see them repeating their talking points. Sometimes you'd see them and they had actually prepared, you could tell with Ted Cruz that he prepared the way he was going to say it several times. And so it had this artificial quality to it. So you have all this artificial stuff that the consultants are throwing at them. And then you have this one guy who, if he's got consultants, they're operating on a very light touch, because it doesn't sound like anyone has a lot of influence over Donald Trump. He didn't sound like a robot. I thought he sounded crazy sometimes, but he didn't sound like a robot, and there was something very satisfying about that. Part of what makes this whole process so vomit-inducing is that it is marketing presidential candidates like breakfast cereal, as someone once said. And at a certain point, it's not just an insult to our intelligence, it's an insult to our democracy. I mean, the whole thing we teach our kids about this country. And the more that the political displays become vacuous, you know, media operations. I mean, how far have we come from the days when, you know, Richard Nixon didn't want to put on makeup, supposedly, in the televised debate with John F. Kennedy because it was, you know, something almost artificial. And now the whole thing is practically scripted as much as they can do it. And so when somebody steps out of that box, it's refreshing as heck and appears to be, you know, that's what makes Donald Trump stand out. As my wife said, you never know what he's going to say next, which is what's going to get him killed almost certainly farther along in this process. Nonetheless, you can't say that for any of these other people, because in a way, nothing that comes out of their mouth is surprising. It was, you know, even the people that I liked more than others up there, I thought were very disappointing last night. I think Rand Paul has a message sometimes, especially on foreign policy, that I like. I don't think he did a good job last night of enunciating it at all. And I think the things he said made him sound much more like a normal politician that's listening way too much to consultants. When he slammed Chris Christie for, I mean, Chris Christie did the obvious and pulled the 9/11 card and basically said something like when Rand Paul went after him for supporting, you know, surveillance and whatnot, Chris Christie basically, you know, if I can paraphrase here, said, I was closer to New York than you were, you know. We see things when you have to bury people. And then Paul said something about him hugging the president. And then he said, you know, I hugged the 9/11 victims. I mean, you turn around and just go, this is, it's bad theater. And it's so predictable. And, you know, you kind of would hope that, thank goodness that Donald Trump was in the race. Because I would have hoped you would have seen more of a Rand Paul or someone like that pull an out-of-left-field sort of outsider stunt, and I thought he sounded very middle-of-the-road-ish, listening to the same consultants that the other side was. I mean, who cares if Chris Christie hugs the president? What the hell does that? I mean, it's just pathetic. And the things out of Trump's mouth, you could see. I mean, I'll give you another example, and this is, again, where the people are puzzled. You know, Trump goes off about the immigration thing, right? Wants to build this wall with a nice door, or whatever he said, right? And then Chris Wallace, the Fox News moderator, basically tried to nail him down. I do think he got nailed on a bunch of issues that the other candidates were kind of let off on. But just nailing him on, how do you know that? Right? So he's talking about all the bad things coming over the border. And Chris Wallace was saying, you know, where's your evidence for that? What do you know that? And Trump was reduced to basically saying the equivalent of, you know, I go to the border and talk to people or something like that. The point is that in any normal situation, you know, he's burned by that, right? That should be an awful moment for his campaign. But nobody cared. I mean, I think the other candidates rolled their eyes like, you know, what do we have to do to impact this guy? But I think the people listening kind of just went, who cares? We know he's saying what we want to say. We don't care about this evidence you're looking for, right? We like what he says. And we like that he's not afraid to say it. And we like that the other people on the stage are too politically correct to say what a lot of Americans think. Listen, I don't think it wins you the general elections, but when you got a bunch of people up there who want to be just one little step more conservative than the next guy, just conservative enough to win the primaries, but not too conservative that you lose the rest of the country you have to win to beat a Hillary Clinton or something later, and then Trump turns it up to 11. That's my new favorite phrase, by the way, obviously. It's from Spinal Tap, but now I'm using it all the time. It's going to be my phrase after a while through just squatter's rights. Nonetheless, that's what he does. Instead of playing the little game where I'm going to be one step more conservative than the other guy, he goes 10,000 steps more conservative and says, they're all drug users and criminals and rapists, and we ought to build a wall with a door. Do better than that. And they can't follow him there. The playbook doesn't work anymore. If they follow Trump that far down the road, if Ted Cruz starts saying, listen, the polling data shows these people in the early primary states like what he's saying about Mexicans and drugs and rapists, I better match that. He's doomed in the general elections. That's the old Vietnam line. Then you've destroyed the village in order to save it, right? You said what you needed to do to beat Trump in the primaries and lost the generals in the process. It's why I like outsiders. It puts them in a position where they're sweating bullets right now because he's messing up the playbook. It's the same thing that happens when you get a Ross Perot, third-party independent candidate in the debates. They're not playing by the playbook. Bernie Sanders is not playing by the playbook. The Democratic Party's sweating, trying to finagle as few debates as possible, as late as possible. I mean, you know, the status quo in that party doesn't like where that's going. Status quo in the Republican Party doesn't like the Donald Trump thing. I heard Mr. Priebus, the head of the party, the other day, kind of trying to hedge his bets a little bit before he could say Donald Trump's, you could make it sound like he won't be a problem. He's not good for the party. Now, all of a sudden, with the polling numbers where they are, he's got to kind of get into line a little bit. But he's screwing up everybody's playbook, because here's the thing. After the debate performance last night, I was able to predict, along with 10,000 of the rest of you, almost certainly, that Trump's performance was going to raise his standing in the polls, because he doubled down on all these things people like, and next to the robotic, overly coached and scripted, you know, competitors, he looked great. Now, he's going to go one toke over the line at some point. You wait. It's just there's too much time for Trump to say something that even the supporters who like the straight talk and the lack of political correctness, there'll be something, he'll pull a John McCain is no hero kind of line again or something like that. But before that happens, he's looking like the one person who's his own man up there and who's not afraid to say unpopular things and isn't monitoring every word he says because, oh my gosh, I might lose the presidency. Big deal. I'll go back to my day job, which is making billions of dollars, and I bought all these candidates. And by the way, wasn't that the fascinating moment of the debate? And again, something that never would have happened if, one, you hadn't had an outsider up there, and two, you hadn't had an outsider with billions of dollars up there. That was fascinating. You will not see that with Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders can say, you know, all these candidates are taking money and being bought by, you know, outside billionaire interests and everything. Donald Trump can say, I bought you, and I bought you, and I gave you a bunch of money. That was fascinating. And then to have another candidate say, you didn't give me any money, and another one to say, I'll take some money from you. And then have Rand Paul say, well, that's the problem. You know, this guy's buying up candidates left and right, and he's basically saying, yeah, I am. And you know what? When I do, they do what I tell them. The party is sweating bullets. Come on, you think the GOP likes to have a billionaire up there who actually gives money to their people and says, yeah, and then they do what I want? Oh, boy. That is not playing by the rules. And I have to tell you something. I don't like Donald Trump. I didn't like any of those candidates up there for the Republican Party I saw last night, but I liked that. I want to see Donald Trump in another debate because I want to see another moment like that. How often do I talk about these emperor has no clothes moments and how so much of what's going on in this country won't stand the light of day? The problem is how do you give it the light of day? It's not that easy, especially when all these people are sort of, you know, involved in the system that we want to see reformed. I've often compared it to going to the fox and requiring the fox's help to redesign the chicken coop so that it's fox-proof. The only time that people bring that kind of crap up is when they're not foxes, when they're outsiders, right? But how do you get an outsider into the political system these days? They keep making it harder and harder, except that sometimes you get them running inside the parties. Donald Trump is saying stuff up there that I would pay somebody. Probably not Donald Trump wages, but, you know, I mean, in my mind, somebody up there exposing this system by saying, yeah, I buy you people all the time. I'll buy you. And what did the one guy say? Give me some money. And Trump said something like, no problem. Okay. I mean, I'm sorry. As they used to say, you know, you can't pay for that kind of publicity if you're trying to expose, you know, a corrupt system, right? The only people that are going to bring that up are people from outside the system. And sometimes you don't get to pick them. Do I wish we could have a Cincinnatus-type character, you know, a mythical George Washington-type character who would come in and be just, you know, this accomplished, intelligent, compassionate, make them a woman, you know, throw in this perfect candidate? I'd love that. Of course I would. But if my choices are the perfect outsider or no outsider, I'm feeling like a beggar who can't be a chooser in these kinds of situations, right? At this point, I think outsiders expose the hypocrisy of the system, and I love seeing them up there on stage, even if personally they are really not my type. And look at the problem that these Republicans are going to have coming up, too. I mean, they're not exactly, you know, the funny thing is they're playing to the entire United States at these debates. But at the same time, it's not the entire United States that they have to convince that they're the right candidate. And we alluded to this a little while ago when we talked about the primary system. There's Americans who understand this. This might be more for non-Americans because this is part of the intricacy of our governmental system. And every country has these things. It's why I don't like to, you know, start talking too much about the politics of other countries, because these intricacies are difficult for outsiders to understand. You know, for example, how the House of Lords and the House of Commons interacts in Britain over the history. I mean, these are things that as a non British person I'd feel uncomfortable wading into. I might quote other people, but I'd feel uncomfortable analyzing it myself. And I imagine for outsiders, the American system is very similar, and the primary system is quite arcane. First of all, understand something. The primaries are not a part of the constitutional design of the United States, okay? There's nothing in the Constitution about primaries. The primaries are creations of the two parties, which are also not in the constitutional design. There's nothing about parties in the constitutional design. No matter what the two parties tell you, they like you to believe we're a two-party country, which is the best propaganda you can have if you happen to be one of those two parties. They set their own rules on these primaries, except in some states, the states have managed to set some rules. Now, here's a point worth making, too, is that these states have different kinds of primaries. Some of them have what are called open primaries, which allow anyone to vote in anyone's primary. I think you can still only vote in one, though. You can't vote in both Democratic and Republican primary, but some states are open. Other states are kind of open. They won't let a member of the other big party vote in their primary, but independents and stuff can. And then some are closed primaries where only the people in the party can vote. And while there was some worry about monkey wrenching at times, I mean, for example, with John McCain's campaign, there were charges that Democrats were voting in Republican primaries to screw up the candidate that the Republicans ended up with. But by and large, if you look at the polls, the people that vote in these things are the more diehards. First of all, the people that vote are the more diehards, and then the people that vote in these primaries tend to be the more diehards for the parties. And if you see the candidates moving to the right, well, that's who they're trying to appeal to, evangelicals, and deeply conservative people who form, you know, the GOP base. And listen, the Democrats try to do the same thing. So even when you have these open primaries, for example, in South Carolina, that's an open primary, doesn't mean you have tons of African Americans going and voting in the GOP primaries in general, right? So let's just understand that's a dynamic that theoretically should make this stuff more representative, but in reality doesn't. In any case, the key thing about the primaries that's just weird, if you're an outsider, is the way they're structured in terms of scheduling and order. Because in a more logical system, the Republicans would have a day, today's primary day, Republican Party primary day, and it would be like a mini presidential election. And the whole country, all the Republicans eligible to do so, would vote in the primaries or whichever groups in a caucus, some of these states have caucuses, would vote. And then at the end of the day, you'd have this wonderful, you know, polls have closed and here's the Republican primary winner. But that's not how it works. The way it works, and it works this way in the Democratic Party too, is you get to have one of these votes in one place, and then you get a break, and everybody gets to obsess over what that vote meant and said. The candidates that did good in that first vote, you know, probably get some more money added to their campaigns. The ones who did poorly might see some of it dry up, and then after a certain period of time, you have another one of these primaries in another place. And then it repeats itself again, right? But you can draw even more conclusions. A candidate that did well in the first one but not the second one, you're going to read one way. Candidate that did well in the, you know, second one but not the, I mean, you know, every which way. Lost both of them, won both of them. I mean, these will be parsed and obsessed over for 8 or 9 days, and then you'll have another one. In other words, it's a domino-like system that begins to build a momentum. So by the time you're 3 or 4 of these primaries or caucuses into these things, you know, people are already either doomed or coming from nowhere. I mean, you begin to see the whittling down of the choices before almost anyone's had any say in it. I mean, listen to this primary schedule for this year. The first thing, as always, this is weird too, will be on Monday, February 1st. The Iowa caucus. Now, let's look at all this from a GOP point of view right now, a Republican point of view. The Iowa caucus on February 1st. So this is a small group of Republicans in Iowa. Iowa is not a representative state, by the way, for you folks outside the country. It's a heartland state, down-home values, farming a lot, not urban at all, and mostly white. Now, remember, you're not talking either about a cross-section of voters from Iowa. You're talking about a specific subset. So not only is Iowa not particularly representative of the mass of voters in the country, especially the ones who represent the giant populous states, but you're only getting the Republican voters in there, and usually only a percentage of them, especially in a caucus, right? So the very first vote we get on any of this stuff comes at the hands of a particularly unrepresentative group of Americans. Now, You can make a case that the Iowa caucus has become less and less important over like the last 20 years or so, seems to be much less representative of what's going to happen, you know, in the generals than the next one that's coming up. Although, look how much time people spend in Iowa before the actual caucus there. I mean, it's one of the ways supposedly you could tell that people are thinking about running for president. They've been seen in Iowa. Why the hell have they been seen in Iowa? Well, that's where the Iowa caucus is, the first time anyone has a chance to vote. The second time anyone has a chance to vote is in New Hampshire. And it's in New Hampshire's state constitution that it always stay that way. If any of the other states move up their timetable, New Hampshire's required in their bylaws to do the same thing so that they're still the first primary. Iowa's a caucus. New Hampshire's the first primary. This year it happens Tuesday, February 9th. Excuse me, next year is the 2016 election. So Tuesday, February 9th. So that's 8 days after the Iowa caucus. So you've had 8 days to digest whatever the hell you learned in the Iowa caucus, to obsess over it, for the media to make a big deal out of it, for donors to start switching their chips around or what have you, for people to start honing their message or changing their message, or out of desperation pulling out that opposition research that we weren't going to use, but we're starting to panic a little. Whatever it might be, and then New Hampshire happens. And New Hampshire, by the way, over the last 20 or so years, has been a much better predictor of who's going to end up winning the generals. Again, though, New Hampshire? New Hampshire's not a representative state. Once again, not urban. They have a strong libertarian wing to the Republicans there, but also some old-line conservatives. I mean, white. I mean, it's very similar to Iowa in the sense of it being not very representative of the great mass of people in the states that you normally think of as being, you know, the really important places to win if you want to win the overall elections. I mean, you know, when it comes to the general election night and it's the Democratic nominee against the Republican nominee, very few of them are going to be going, which way did New Hampshire go? They're going to be saying, what's New York going to do? What's California going to do? What's Florida going to do, right? What's Ohio going to do? But those states don't vote anytime soon in the primaries. By the time most of those states get to vote, the candidate will be picked. In other words, when you have a chance to get a really good cross-section of the voters that you have to win the general elections, your candidate's been chosen, and they've been chosen by a bunch of states that are really not representative of the general election. Now, you may be saying, yes, Dan, Iowa, New Hampshire, it's a legacy of another time. It is what it is, but then you'll have South Carolina on February 20th, which is 11 days to obsess after the New Hampshire's, right? South Carolina, much more urban state than Iowa and New Hampshire, you would think. Much more diverse, too. There's a lot of African Americans, for example, in South Carolina. Yeah, but you know what? I'd be shocked if South Carolina has an urban center with more than 150,000 people in it. Compare that, by the way, to the city of Los Angeles that has almost 4 million people in it, okay? And then when you think about South Carolina's diversity, absolutely, what is it, about 25-30% African American? But how many of them vote GOP? So how much of the GOP primary vote in South Carolina is going to be a diverse vote that will be more representative when picking candidates of what some candidate has to win in the general election, right? Instead, you're going to be getting some of the most conservative of conservative Republican voters in South Carolina. It's a very conservative state when you get to the Republican side of it. Lindsey Graham is the representative, right? South Carolina, by the way, often called the Republican firewall state, because it's believed that when they have insurgent candidates that the party maybe doesn't like so much, Donald Trump, I'm maybe looking at you, South Carolina is often where the party mechanism manages to shut them down, or at least that's the general consensus. 3 days after South Carolina, you get the Nevada caucus. Nevada's a conservative state anyway. The Republicans in Nevada are old-line Western state conservative, which for you folks outside the United States, it's, you know, the regions sort of have different versions of liberalism and conservatism and all that. Nevada falls into a similar category with a place like Arizona, where the conservatives of Arizona are like old Western desert conservatives. I mean, they're hard to describe. And then when you get all the way to the far west coast, you get a different kind of Republican. You get like the Orange County, California Republicans, and they're a different breed. It's the difference between things, you know, like New York liberals are very different, for example, than, you know, Pacific Northwest liberals. I mean, it's regional stuff. Every country's got this. Nonetheless, On February 23rd, you're going from South Carolina conservative, one kind of really conservative American, to Nevada conservative, another kind of really conservative American, none of them particularly representative of the country as a whole, or even of conservatives and Republicans as a whole. Right? I mean, if you're doing this and then you're going, well, what about New York Republicans and Washington State Republicans and Republicans in California? Think of the choices that the people in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada are making, right? Are these the Republicans you want to win? And then you get Super Tuesday on March 1st, where you will probably see the candidate finalized. And that's where you get a bunch of states all together. But most of them are like Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia. Right? California has no say. New York has no say. I don't believe Ohio or Pennsylvania have any say. I mean, these are all states that when you want to win the national election, need to think you're the right person for the job, but they have no say in deciding if you get to be that person. So this is where the arcane primary system kills you, and it kills you on a number of fronts. One, this tiny group of non-representative people has an outsized say in who actually, you know, we all get to vote on. Is it any wonder we often say, why are these our candidates? Well, partially because look who's picking them. And by the way, that's no offense to any of these primary states. They're just very different than the, you know, population centers of the country. And the population center of the country are where the majority of the people are. And one would think that the people who end up getting the job of representing us would be the people most supported by the people. In other words, it's my belief that the people in California ought to have as much of a say in who the final candidate is as the people of Iowa. Is that controversial? Nonetheless, as I said, some logical European or Pacific Rim person or someone from China would look at this and say, that's a screwed up system. All the people ought to vote the same day, but it works the way it works. And there's a domino effect, and it becomes one of the ways the parties get to have more of a say in who the candidate is than most of us, when you learn your high school civic stuff, would think that this system should allow. Again, it's part of how the two parties have an outsized control over how this country's run, as opposed to the idea of some pure democracy where we pick the people who say the things we want and who are going to take the country in the direction we want. No, we pick the better of the two bad people running for president that says the least offensive stuff. Or, if you're not a very savvy voter, you vote for the person with the letter next to the name you like. Nonetheless, what this weird primary system does is force these candidates to construct campaigns designed to win these non-representative early votes. So in other words, instead of crafting a John Kasich-like message, which, by the way, if you saw the debates last night, I think it was interesting watching people look at John Kasich and review his performance. If you didn't see the debates, what Kasich did was sort of go against the tenor of the room. And he was talking, I think, about gay marriage or something. He was talking about unconditional love, and that's what he learns, and he's accepting of everybody and all these things. And especially unlike the other liberal networks and whatnot, he got a lot of praise. You know, if you're a Democrat, you're always going to think that the Republican who sounded the most like a Democrat did a good job. Nonetheless, Kasich came at this from an angle where he wasn't trying to organize his approach to appeal to the Iowa caucus voters or the New Hampshire voters. And not that those people, you know, in a broad cross-section would oppose that. It's just that specifically all these people are trying to out-conservative, out-hardline, out-authenticity the other people up there. And Kasich was so obviously not playing that game. Neither, by the way, was Jeb Bush. But see, here's the one thing that can counteract the early primary question. The people that can't afford to lose the early primaries are the people that no one's quite sure are going to make it. The people that can afford to maybe jettison the early primaries in the hopes of being more electable when the generals come are the people that come into this thing, you know, as sort of front runners, not necessarily number one, but somewhere with so much name recognition and cachet from the very get-go that they could afford to lose in Iowa or afford to lose in New Hampshire without being, you know, mortally wounded. Jeb Bush could afford losses in those states when a person, for example, like Ben Carson couldn't, right? So in other words, you might have a candidate that who has a rather nuanced position on a very hot-button cultural question. Let's just take abortion, for example. You could have a candidate up there that had a very nuanced position about it, but can't afford to show that nuance because they know that they've got to appeal to a much more conservative demographic in order to get the chance to appeal to the great mass of Americans in the general election. So they have to adopt a more strident position than one that they'd rather take when they, you know, run as the candidate for the entire country in order to get a chance to run as the candidate for the entire country. Once again, this would be something that wouldn't happen if these primaries all happened at once, instead of this system where we start with these really conservative, non-representative ones and then start whittling people down from there. And if you want to do it that way, it needs to be done in the reverse order. You should have the big populous states first and, you know, then ask Iowa and New Hampshire and Nevada and all those places how they feel. But at least you'd be able to say, look, there's just not that many people where you are. The way it is now is the opposite. And who thinks that makes sense? Well, except for some of the people in those states. If you live in New Hampshire, it's a state law, man. So that's the arcane primary system. And there's a playbook that's been developed over decades to sort of guide a candidate through, you know, the way to win that system. And the people that screw up the playbook are the outsiders. By turning it up to 11, avoiding any nuance at all, refusing to play I'm one little step more conservative than you, by doing that, you know, Trump takes everybody and forces them in a position where there are no playbooks anymore for how you react. Take the immigration issue. When Trump made the comments about them all being, you know, what did he say, drug runners or drug dealers and rapists and all that, I mean, that's a little, what that forces the other people to do who are trying to look like they're really hardliners on immigration, they now have to back up and turn in the other direction, right? Now, this is a very bad analogy. I'm not trying to reflect anything on any of these candidates or the immigration issue or anything, but it's a little like the Southern racism that you got during, you know, the 1960s, where they would have these veiled sort of campaigns where racism and separation and all these things were kind of what they were selling, but you couldn't come out and say it. And then having some candidate come out here and say, we ought to lynch them all from trees. And then all the people that wanted, you know, segregated schools and all that kind of stuff have to turn around and go, well, now, wait a minute. I'm not talking about anything like that. I you know, but if you're trying to look like the toughest candidate on, you know, anti-civil rights, the, you know, the racist who wants to hang people from trees just blew your whole strategy out of the water, didn't he? As I said, not trying to suggest that this is anything like that. But my point is that when Donald Trump takes everything to 11, the other people have to walk it back in the other direction. There's no playbook, you know, plan for that. It's why the party sweats when these outsiders come in. And it's why I think the outsiders are so useful, whether or not I like them. Isn't it weird to say I think Donald Trump is good for the system? But I do. Is he good for the system if he wins? No. But right now, he's exposing a bunch of things, including, you know, I think wonderfully exposing the robots he's up against. I mean, all the funny thing is that all of those people, all of those other GOP hopefuls, most of them anyway, if you got them alone, they're real people. They'll understand gray areas and nuance. There's a couple maybe that wouldn't. But by and large, you know, if you get these people in a back room and they're not running for office and you could really pick their brains, I'm sure there's a ton to them in terms of depth and flexibility and all. But boy, when you're dealing with the campaign strategists and all these people that put you in a box and organize you and market you and you turn into these automatons. And when you do that, it's bad enough when it's a bunch of robots up there. But maybe you could convince yourself that it's not as robotic as you think it is until you see a human being next to them. And then by comparison, the human being, you know, makes the other people look completely plastic, completely fake. Robotic is really the perfect word. And Donald Trump got up there and made people like Rand Paul, who I was hoping would be the non-robotic person up there that exposed the other people's roboticness, made even Rand Paul seem robotic, at least to me. Listen, I have a feeling, I could be wrong about this, but I have a feeling that this is exactly what Bernie Sanders is going to do to Hillary Clinton, too. Going to show this absolutely fake political creation. Again, I bet if you got Hillary into a room, same thing with Marco Rubio, I bet you could find a really some depth and some real thought but that's not what you're going to see, and none of that's going to be on display, right? We're going to have a plastic face we show the crowd, a kabuki mask, and if Bernie Sanders manages to say something or do something that can rip that kabuki mask off, I'm sorry, he just made himself invaluable in terms of what I would consider to be the road to reform, in the same way that I saw Trump rip off a bunch of kabuki masks last night. And listen, if I'm pro anything, it's pro ripping. Maybe, should I say, Ben, if I'm anything, I'm anti-kabuki mask? Well, you know what I mean, folks. Basically, I want the emperor's nudity to be exposed, and it might take a guy as abrasive and willing to, you know, go off script and take a chance of saying something wild as Donald Trump to say something like, hey, this system's corrupt. I ought to know. I'm giving money to all of you. I'm sorry. To me, that's a priceless comment, regardless of my personal thoughts on what a Trump presidency would look like. We've been telling you about Ting for some time now, mobile service made easy. And I read a news story the other day that made me think of, you know, some of the things we brought up, you know, over the times we've been talking about Ting. A major cell phone company out there this week announced that they're going to ditch the long-term contracts that they've always, you know, enforced, where, you know, if you want a phone deal with them, you have to sign up for a certain number of years, and if you want to leave early, you have to pay a penalty. Ting's never done anything like that. And you wonder, sort of, if those companies would be making those changes if it wasn't for the pressure that companies like Ting have been putting on them in the customer service realm. But, you know, it's not just customer service where they can compete with these big firms. How about the way that most businesses have competed for your business from time immemorial? Lower prices. On their front page, I believe, Ting has something called a savings calculator. You don't do that unless you think the vast majority of people that will come there and fill in their information will end up saving money with you. It's not everybody. It's just most of you. Why don't you head on over there and see if you would save money using Ting? Remember, they only charge you for what you use, the data you use, the time you use. There are no overage charges or penalties, no add-on charges, no mysterious line items on your bill. Why don't you see if you'd save a little money using their savings calculator? And I tell you what, I can save you a little money right now. If you go to dancarlin.ting.com, you'll get a $25 service credit when you sign up.
If you are not already following us on Twitter, please do so. The address is @DC Common Sense.
You want to help the podcasts? Just buy your Amazon.com products through the Amazon search window on DanCarlin.com, and Dan and Ben will get a percentage of what you spend. It doesn't cost you a penny more, and it helps these guys out because they are nice young fellas.
For the 10 years we've been doing this program, we have periodically updated you folks as to sort of how the business / podcast side of this is going. And I've benefited greatly, by the way, by doing that, by sharing it and being open about it. You folks have solved lots of my problems over the years. Great ideas, outside-the-box solutions. Some of you have just come forward and moved mountains when we needed you to. We're probably overdue, in fact, for one of these updates. The same thing happens to me every time, though, I take a deep breath and think about what I want to say in something like this. And it's this, I sort of dissolve into a wallowing pool of gratitude, folks, because I'm still amazed. There's almost an unbelieving sort of sense that we're still here and everything's going well. And I know who I have to thank for that. So I'm always so grateful to all of you. I remember when there was like 50 of you, I felt like I knew every single one of you. The good news about this operation, in large part because of everything you folks have done for us, is that the listenership continues to grow. And without bragging, I mean, we have enough people listening to where we can say, listen, you know, we have more listeners than some of the mainstream media stuff out there. That's amazing. It's a testament to podcasting. And really, I mean, there didn't even used to be a big enough potential audience out there of people who even knew what this was and were listening, to the point where it is now, where, you know, a guy doing this out of his home studio with the cat litter box not that far away, I mean, it's not anything but glamorous. And yet, look at what, with your help, we have going here. Now, my lawyer had a great line, though, when I was complaining to him not that long ago about things, and he said, listen, with greater success comes greater complexity. And if there's any problems that we're facing here with this wonderful little dream come true of an operation, it's all due to the fact that you know, more people are listening, which creates more things that need doing. And, you know, I've spoken, and I know, other new media people and their operations. And if you reach a certain success point, you get to this fork in the road moment, and how you're going to handle it has a big impact on where you go from this point on. Now, I have acquaintances who decided to handle the increasing complexity in the way you might imagine anybody should. They start hiring people or taking on interns or what have you. But I also know that it, you know, it creates one of two dynamics or both. One dynamic is you give up a lot of control and you have a lot of people running the operation in their own little sections, and you kind of lose the ability to oversee everything. If you're a control freak like I am, that's a very difficult thing to do. I have sort of a Hitlerian business organization going here where everything one way or another goes through me. Now, that creates a great quality control system there because, you know, it doesn't get through me unless it meets my standards. But it makes it very hard for anyone to help. And because of that, keeping the lights on and everything that goes to maintaining the operation we have here takes up a ton of our time. And so many of you have offered to help with that, you know, work for free, be interns, whatever. But that would make me a human resources manager 30% of the time or something. And I don't want to do that. I want to do exactly what I'm doing right here, right now. But we pay a price for that. And the price we're paying more and more is not meeting these self-imposed release dates for programs. It's been affecting Hardcore History for a long time. It's affecting Common Sense now. I mean, it's been a month, if you were actually waiting for this show, since we gave you one. That's a long time. So I've been pulling my hair out over this, what little there is left of it, and, you know, working weekends a lot of the time, but just like all of you other small business owners, right? And my wife is a perfect person to have some input on this because she sees exactly what's going on, and she's a much more efficient person than I am. She can multitask. I can hardly unitask, right? And a great business mind, which I don't have. And she's observing what I'm doing. And she said to me the other day when I was saying, you know, it's been too long since a Common Sense show, we got to get a Common Sense show out. And she said, listen, she says, let me tell you what you're really losing work time and what's really killing you. She said, I watch you go from one of your shows and then switch gears because you think you have to get another of your other shows out. And when you switch gears, it takes you 2 days to 3 days to get into the other frame of mind. And then you do that other show, and then you got to go back to the first one, and it takes you 2 or 3 days to get into that frame of mind. She goes, you're losing a ton of days. She goes, in addition to that, you used to be able to get a Common Sense show out in a day or two or three. Now it takes you 5 or 6 or 7. If you're trying to get a Common Sense show out every 2 weeks, she said to me the other day, it means you have about a week in between to not just do your Hardcore History stuff, but to also do all the business stuff. And she says it takes you 2 or 3 days to get back into the proper mood to do that. She goes, this is why it's getting ever longer. She says you have to stop switching back and forth. Now, I've been complaining for some time that I feel like the Common Sense show gets a little repetitive, right? Because there's, you know, we used to say in news that there's only 5 or 6 real stories in the world, and that every one you see on the newscast is a variation of one of those. Well, I don't know if that's true, but sometimes when we're looking at the similarities of the topics to the program we do, it feels like that. And part of that is self-inflicted, because a while back I told you that, you know, once I had determined that there's really almost no reason to talk about a lot of the political problems until you solve the big corruption problem, you know, we've narrowed our focus down to what I always think of as root causes, but it also gives you less topics to play with and choose from. And so my wife's right. I mean, I've been thinking lately that sometimes I'll come out of the Hardcore History work simply because I feel like I'm supposed to come out and give a program. But what if I have nothing useful to add to things we've said many times, right? Do you really want me doing that? Like the big news story lately, and it is a big one, it's very important, is the whole Iran potential nuclear deal, right? But, you know, if you think about it, and I realize not everybody's heard everything we've ever done, but we've done a ton of shows on Iran. We've done shows on nuclear nonproliferation. We've done multiple shows on Iran, I think, and nuclear nonproliferation. So unless I've changed my mind about something, do I have anything of value to offer by giving you the same point of view I have? Especially if you've heard, I mean, if you're a new person, I understand, but if you've heard me for years, is that what you waited around for and downloaded something for, right? Something we gave you already? I was always bad at that in talk radio where you're always supposed to repeat things, and I'm not real good at it in podcasting either. And I wonder if I don't have anything that I think is really useful to share, should I break up the momentum if I'm in a good place on the other show and do it? My wife is suggesting that I'm being an idiot doing the way I'm doing things, and you folks have proven by improving the way I do things in the past that it wouldn't have been the first time. So I thought about this a little bit more. I don't want to end anything, but what I think I might start doing is releasing the idea of release schedules in my head. And if I'm in a good place on either one of the shows, just keep going. You know, whenever the muse hits and I'm in a groove, I'd like to continue that. I'm going to stop feeling this mythical due date in my head and try to do with the Common Sense Show what has been long the policy on the Hardcore History Show, which is we're about quality. Now, there may be a ceiling to how much quality I can give you, but that's always going to be job one in our head. One of the wonderful things about this podcast that makes it better, well, to me, than television or any other medium out there that's currently going, is I don't have due dates. I don't have to sit there and eventually go, you know what? This is as good as I can make it with this due date. I mean, if it has to be on the internet forever, cast in digital stone, like we always say, I want to make it as good as I can make it. And part of the reason I think the Hardcore History due dates get longer is I always want to do a better show than the show before. But the show before was as good as I could do. I mean, I tell my wife, I'm in a lucky position to use every darn brain cell I have. And I feel like I'm really, whatever potential I have, right, I'm maxing it out. And then you do a show and you think, okay, now what am I going to do for the next show? And I think to myself, well, it has to be better than the one we just did. And I famously, you know, if you've heard me talk about this before, I can't even listen to stuff I did 2 years ago. Drives me crazy. The only thing I can stand is the last thing we did, and I'm ready to do better than that. But that just means you work harder and longer, and you become more almost OCD about everything. But folks, you know what? When I used to do radio, 5 days a week, 3 hours a day, the amount of crud that makes it through all of your filters simply to fill time, if you do it long enough, and I did it for a pretty long time, I don't know. Some people had different attitudes. My attitude was, if I ever get editorial control over this stuff and can do it just the way I want it, I'm going to minimize crud. And I'm not going to deal with any deadlines that say, listen, you have 3 hours to fill today. If all you have is crud, crud's what you're giving the audience. If that's all I have for you today, you're not getting a podcast today. And you know me, the way things have been going lately, you might not get one tomorrow either. But listen, you'll get this one, and hopefully it was worth your time. And the next time I think I have something worth your time, you'll get one then too. Thank you for your patience. My goal is to always make you feel like when we give you something, it was worth your time. I'm going to try to keep the amount of time you have to wait for those kinds of offerings to a minimum. Thanks again for everything, folks.